Okay, we begin here on the top of Ayin Bet Amud Aleph, three lines down. Tanu Banan, Yisrael shelava ma'ot min ha'nachri biribit. Israel who borrowed money from a non-Jew with interest, which is no problem, that is a permissible transaction. V'zakfan alav b'milveh. And then he accumulated the entire amount and made it into a loan. So instead of it being now where he's collecting interest on an ongoing basis, they've reached a point where either the loan is due, or there's enough interest payments that have passed where he hasn't paid them yet, and so they accrue the entire outstanding amount into a single debt. So instead of it being interest and debt now, there's simply one block of debt that he owes him. Then v'nit gayer, he converts. Im kodim shenit gayer, zekvan alav b'milveh. If prior to his conversion, he had converted the entire debt into debt, meaning that there's no longer any interest left, govata keren v'govata ribit, then the ger can collect both the keren and the ribit because it's no longer interest. It was interest payments before, but once the interest payments are now an obligation to pay and they have passed, when he makes it into a outstanding debt, then all that's left is principal amount and that he's allowed to collect. But after he converted, zakfan alav b'milveh, then he converted the whole thing into a debt, goveta karen, veno goveta ribit. Then he's entitled to collect the principal amount, but he's not only entitled to collect the interest. So the easiest way to understand this is in a case where he lent them 100, and he expects them to pay back 120 at a fixed time. So if he comes to collect 120, the 120 is 100 of principal and 20 of interest. If it's already reached the due date of the 120, and he says, okay, the entire 120 now is outstanding debt, then it changes from being principal and interest to purely a principal amount. So they passed the due date in a sense, and now that he owes him the money, he makes the entire amount that he owes him into an outstanding debt. So it's somewhat akin to a paid in kind, a PIC debt, where instead of paying the interest itself, the interest now accumulates into the underlying debt and becomes outstanding debt. So that's fine, because once it's a debt, he can collect it once he's a ger. If it remains separated as principal and interest, then he can't collect it once he's a ger, because then he's a Jew and he'd be collecting from Israel interest. So the key threshold is, once he's converted, prior to that point, if it's already been established as outstanding debt, it's fine. If it's after that point, it's problematic, because then it becomes principal and interest, and as a Jew to a Jew, he can't charge him interest. The reverse scenario, where a non-Jew borrowed money for Yisrael, biribit, with interest. Again, permissible, might be problematic, mid the Rabbanan, but assuming that it was fine because it's kedei chayav, or whatever other heter he used, and then they accrued all the interest that he owed until that point in time and made it into a debt obligation, and then he converts. If prior to the conversion, he made it all into a debt, or outstanding debt, goveta karen v'goveta ribit, he's allowed to collect the karen and ribit, because it's no longer karen and ribit, it's all karen, it's all principal amount now. If it's after he already converted, then he converted the entire outstanding debt and interest into a principal amount, then goveta karen v'en goveta ribit, then he's entitled to collect the principal amount. He's not entitled to collect the interest because of the fact that now he's a Jew. And you can't take interest payments from a Jew. In the case of the Seifa, the latter case in this Braita, where it's a non-Jew borrowing from a Jew with interest, ben kach, u ben kach goveta keren v'goveta ribit. The Jew is entitled to collect the interest and the principal amount. So Rabbi Yossi believes that in a case where the non-Jew converts and becomes a Jew, you're still allowed to collect the interest even after he becomes a Jew. Amar Rav, Amar Rav Chista, Amar Rav Huna, halacha ke Rabbi Yossi. The halacha is like Rabbi Yossi in this case. And Amar Rav, my time at the Rabbi Yossi. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Yossi's position? Kedei shelo yomru bishvil ma'utav nitkayer zeh. Because we don't want to cast dispersions on his conversion to say that he only converted to get out of the debt obligation or the interest obligation that he owed. Maybe it was too burdensome on him. So he figures by converting, he can get rid of the interest that he owes and he'll only own the principal amount. So maybe he converted in order to save some money. It's a pretty big undertaking to save money, but there are possibilities that the interest rates were pretty high. And if that's the case, then his conversion would be suspect. So in order to prevent that, we have him pay the interest anyway. Now that's interesting only because once he's a Jew, it becomes interest problem mi deoraita, in that you're not allowed to pay. This is ribit tzutza. This is a case of real full-fledged interest payment. And yes, it was permissible when he was non-Jewish. But once he converts and he's a Jew, it's impermissible. So how is it possible that we're saying to him, oh, don't worry about it, just pay the interest? What right do you have to say pay interest and violate an Isur Doraita? Because maybe it'll cast aspersions on his conversion. So either you have to say we're functioning under Hefker Beit Din Hefker, where Beit Din has the right to disown you from your property, and therefore they're able to have this transaction take place without it being deemed interest mi Doraita. The other possibility is that the obligation stems from the agreement up front. The Isur Doraita was at the time that the loan was given and the interest was charged in the shtar, or the agreement was for an interest payment. The actual payment of the interest later on might only be an Isur Dirabanan. Once you've already agreed and this was the obligation you entered, then the latter time period when he actually pays the interest, that might only be an Isur Dirabanan. If you say that, then it's easier to understand what's happening here, is that the Rabbanan say, don't pay the interest. And then in this case, they say, well, since it'll cast aspersions on his conversion, do pay the interest in this case. So it might be that the whole restriction here against paying the interest after he converts is only an Isur Darabanan, because the original obligation stems from when he was a goy, and that was permissible at the time. So the fact that now you don't pay it might only be the Rabbanan. If that's the case, it's much easier to understand what Rabbi Yossi's shita is here, that we say pay the interest anyway. All right, so now the Gemara brings a machloket that we saw back in Baba Kamo, which is Tan Rabbanan. Shtar shekatuv bo ribit. If you have a document with an outstanding loan in it that has interest charged, konsim oto veinu gove lo et hakeren velo et haribit. There is a knas, a fine that is imposed on him. And since he did something that was impermissible, charging interest, then not only does he lose the interest payment, he also loses the principal payment. Divrei Rabbi Meir. So it seems pretty obvious what Rabbi Meir is trying to do. Rabbi Meir is trying to dissuade you from charging interest, because if you're caught charging interest, not only are we going to stop you from receiving the interest, you're going to lose the principal amount of the loan. So there's a certain amount of risk undertaken when you charge interest, because you might not only lose the interest, you might lose the underlying loan. That's why it's a knas. That's a penalty that is imposed on him by Rabbi Meir. The chamim say, goveh et hakeren, ve'enu goveh et haribit. You can collect the principal amount, but you cannot collect the interest payment. But my kamiflegei, what's their argument? Rabbi Meir savar kansinan hetera mishum isura. Rabbi Meir says that we penalize the heter part, the principal amount, because of the isur, because of the ribit that's included. Rabbanan savre lo kansinan hetera mishum isura. And the Rabbanon believe that we are not kones the heter, the principal amount, because of the isur, because of the ribit that is contained within the contract. Now Rashi over here writes, the nature of this contract was, shekata bo ploni love mi ploni mane biribit, kach v'kach lezman ploni. That it was all explicit in the document. That it said, he's borrowing 100 today, he's going to be paying 5% per annum, and then the loan comes due at such and such a date. So everything was explicit in the document. That's the way Rashi explains it. Most of the Rishonim are not comfortable with what Rashi is suggesting over here, because of the fact that that is ribit deoraita, and it's explicit ribit. And that means when the edim signed on the contract, the edim are now edim psulim. They signed in an iser deoraita, knowingly affirming a contract, or signing onto a contract that involved an Isur Doraita of paying ribit. And so most Rishonim are uncomfortable saying that this is the situation, and therefore they suggest that the contract that we're speaking about here, we have a machloket Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim, is a situation in which it's less obvious that there's interest being charged. Because it was so obvious, as Rashi is saying, the Edim are psulim, the whole shtar is pasul, and even the Rabbana would agree you can't collect the principal then, because it's an invalid shtar. The whole thing is invalid from start to finish. And so therefore they suggest that we're speaking about here a case where the rebate is not explicit in the contract. So either it's subsumed or some way hidden in the contract, and they sign on the contract innocently, thinking that there's no rebate here, or they sign on the contract, only find out that there's a rebate after the fact. Either way, the Edim then are not aware of the interest, and that's why they remain Edim Ksherim, and that's why there's an argument about the validity of the principal amount in the contract, because of the fact that it's not explicit rebate. Tosafot, in defense of Rashi, tries to explain why it is that the Edim here are not psulim. Even when you have rebit, ktsutsa, or obvious rebit, why is it that these Edim are not considered to be psulim? Says Vitema, my ain Edim psulim. Kevin shovrim alotisimun. Aren't they in violation of an Isur Doraita, an Isur Lav Doraita, which we're gonna see upcoming at the end of the perek, that there is an Isur on the Edim as well, alotisimun alav neshech, that you're not allowed to charge interest. And so the Edim are included in that restriction. And if that's the case, they become psulim. And even though they personally do not benefit from this, nevertheless, they should be considered avaryanim, no better than an ochel nevelot hachis, which we paskin like Abaye in the Gemara and Sanhedrin makes them psulim le'edut, even though it's a machloket there, we paskin like Abaye. And therefore, why are they considered to be kasher Edim over here? And he says, "V'ainu faresh kohen she'ainu rebit mufurash b'shtar." Don't explain the case here where the rebit, the interest, is not obvious in the shtar. That is the way that the Ramban and many other Rishonim explain the case over here. Elakatav stam ploni chayav leploni maneh bekalalo akerim in a rebit ve'edim lo yadu. In the case where the edim are totally oblivious to the fact that there is dim kein besamuch to kamar Rabbi Yochanan. The mode rabbanim b'shtar yichov mukdamim gzera shemigveh mizvan rishon achinam nigzor shemigveh rebit b'torat keren. You should invalidate the shtar because of the fact that now he might collect the interest without anybody knowing, unbeknownst to someone else. He suggests don't say that the case here is that the edim are not in violation of lotis simun, since it's so obvious and apparent in the contract that Beit Din won't collect it, and therefore they sign on the contract with the knowledge that Beit Din will reject the rebit part of it. So they think that they are fine. So v'yesh lamar, ayri hacha b'ribit d'rabanan. Says that it must be that the contract is a contract for interest that is only rabbinically restricted. V'lo mifsalu b'isur d'rabanan, kein she'im arvichim klum. And here, they're not pasul. Even when you violate isur d'rabanan, you would be pasul. But over here, they're not pasul because they're not personally benefiting from it. So you need both personal benefit and a violation of a restriction derabanan to be pasul beidut midrabanan. First, Balei Tosfot is suggesting here the edim would not be pasul. Afo pisha veira daraita yunifsalim. Even though if it was a Torah restriction that they violated, even if they're not personally benefiting, they'd still be pasul. Inami, and this is the big answer of the Tosfot, afilu bi ribit daraita. Maybe even if the contract has obvious ribit daraita, yeshlach shir, shemaloti simon leinshe bimilve mashmalahu, v'lo be'edim, v'lekach k'sherim. That people think that the restriction of lotis simun, the lav of charging interest, does not apply to edim. And therefore, since they justify it to themselves, or they think they're not in violation of the isur, then they're not considered to be avaryanim to make them pasul the edut, or make the shtar pasul. Tosfot quotes a similar thing that we saw earlier on in the Masechta on Daf Hayam Udbet, the Gabei lo tachmod. It's a machloket about how to explain the Gemara. It says that lo tachmod inshe below dame mashmilu. That people over there mistakenly assume what the avera of his lo tachmod is. And since they make that mistake, they justify their actions because they don't think they're doing anything wrong. And so too, the edim over here, even though they are in violation of an isur doraita, maybe they think that there is no problem. They don't think there's an isur doraita here. Since, in their minds, they don't think there's an Isur Doraita, that makes them that they are still Ksherim because of the fact that they're not intentionally or wantonly violating the Isur Doraita. And so that's how they retain their Kashrut over here. Had they known it was an Isur Doraita, they wouldn't have signed on it. But they justify themselves that they can sign on this contract because for them there's no violation. The lender and borrower, they can work it out themselves. That's their problem that there's a violation in the contract. They're just signing to the validity of the contract. So in that case, it would not disqualify the Edim. So Tosafot, in defense of Rashi, says that the case here is either a Ribbit Rabbanan or it's Ribbit Doraita, where the Edim don't think they're in violation of Nisa Doraita, and that's why the contract remains intact. For the Ramban and many other Rishonim, the case has to be a case where the interest is not obvious. It's subsumed somehow in the contract, and the Edim are Ksherim because they don't know that there is Ribbit in this contract. Now, the other thing is, as you look in the first line of the Tosfot here, it says, Perish Rivam, Deinu Gove Mishabde, Aval Mibnei Chorei Gave, Al Pi Oto Shtar, De'edim Einin Ufsalim, De'ena Meidei Hamas, De'en Marvichim Klum Badavar. So the Rivam makes 2 points, one of which we've already dealt with, is why the Edim are not Psulim, but the Rivam suggests that when Rabbi Meir says that you don't collect the Karen, that means you can't go after encumbered property with this contract. But there still is an outstanding loan, and the person can collect it as if it was an oral loan. So he can go after free and clear property, he can demand repayment of the loan. The Balei Tosafot disagree with that. They point out that Rashi says that, we're going to see in a second, another type of shtar that is pasul. And over there, Rashi suggests that you can only not collect from encumbered property. But unencumbered property, it's totally fine to collect from. And that would be supportive of what the Rivam says over here as well, who is actually Rashi's grandson. So Rabbi Yitzchak, Rabbi Meir is Rashi's son-in-law. So this is Rashi's grandson, the Rivam, who follows in Rashi's footsteps and says that Rabbi Meir, who says you can't collect the principal amount, only means you can't collect from encumbered property. But not to mean that the debt is erased completely. The Balei Tosafot over here, based on the Tosefta and other proofs, suggest that that is not the case. And when Rabbi Meir says you may not collect the Karen, that means through and through, you lose the debt completely. It's as if the debt never existed. Not only can you not collect from encumbered property, you can't even collect from unencumbered property. And Tosafot goes as far as to say, even if there are other witnesses to the loan, or the debtor agrees that he owes the money, says the penalty is a full and thorough penalty to the point with which, even if you have other evidence, the fact that the loan was outstanding, not just the shtar, patur, they forgive the loan and it's as if it didn't exist. And they tell Sefef that says, Nami mashta afilu milva al pekonis, that even if it was an oral loan, not just the shtar, that even in that case, Rabbi Meir penalizes and says you lose the outstanding debt. So Tosafot goes much further to say that Rabbi Meir's knas here is a full knas by which the debt is totally wiped out, no matter what the circumstances are. Rashi takes a much more subtle approach, which is that the debt, as far as its ability to collect from encumbered property, is wiped out, but the debt is still outstanding and has to be paid by the loveh. The malveh just lost his collection rights against the loveh in terms of going after encumbered property or other protections that a creditor normally has. That's what's been taken or stripped away from him. But the necessity to pay the debt is still there, according to Rashi. The problem that the Balei Tosafot have, they really speak about this in Baba Kama and Daf Lamed, is the fact that now the loveh is niskar. The loveh here is also a choteh, he's also a sinner, because we said with regards to payment of interest, both the malveh and the loveh are in violation. So the violation of the loveh is also a violation d'oraita. Yet, if we say, according to Rabbi Meir, the knas eliminates entirely the obligation or the karen, then the loveh, the borrower, is the beneficiary now of that, and he gets the debt forgiven. So almost in a sense, he has a incentive to sign onto a contract in which there's ribbit d'oraita, where he's violating nisa d'oraita, because in the end, he will be able to walk away from this loan and owe nothing once Beit Din gets wind of this and cancels the contract. So Balei Tosafot in Baba Kama deal with this, and in the end they say that the penalty is really focused on the malveh, who is the marviach, the profiter here. And anytime you have a knas, and we had this with regards to gzela as well, the takanat chachamim in terms of returning of gzela, many of those takanot come at the expense of the nigzal, at the expense of the person whose property was stolen. So here we're doing this in order to engender tshuva in the gazlan, but someone's got to pay for that. And many times the takanot to help the gazlan come at the expense of the nigzal. But that happens here as well. Here we're trying to penalize the malveh. It comes here at the benefit of the loveh. But that's not our focus. Our focus is not on the loveh. Our focus is in stopping lenders from lending with interest. Yes, the loveh did something wrong by agreeing to it, But if we penalize the malveh, they won't engage in such practices, even though, again, here, the penalty to him benefits the loveh. That is a sidebar or a side benefit. It's not the intent of the knas. The intent of the knas is to prevent the malvim, the lenders, from doing this, because they could lose everything if they did it. The other thing that Tosafot points out is that even though in general the Gemara paskins is a halachic principle, that halacha could Rabbi Meir b'gzeiru tav, that halacha is always like Rabbi Meir when he puts in a gzeira, he says that's true of Rabbi Meir b'gzeiru tav, but not b'knasot tav. So over here, that principle would not apply, and therefore the halacha would not be like Rabbi Meir, but rather like the chachamim in this instance. The Gemara now asks, it's not autumn. We have a Mishnah in Shvi'it that says, Shtari chova muktamim, if you have predated shtar, psulim, they are problematic, they are invalid. About mu'acharim, those that are post-dated, ksherim, they are fine. Muktamim amai psulim, why is the predated shtar problematic? Dehi, the lo gavu mizman rishon, nigvu mizman sheni. Okay, so fine, they're not valid in terms of their collection from the actual date written on the shtar, but they should at least be valid from the perspective that you can collect from the real date of the loan. The problem with the predated shtar is that it grants the creditor rights to go after the property of the debtor earlier than he really has a right to do so. And the problem becomes when the date on the shtar is predated, and between the date that is mentioned on the shtar and the real loan, the debtor sold property to other parties. So those other parties, when they bought the property, they thought they bought the property without any outstanding debts on the property. Now all of a sudden the guy shows up with a contract and says this debt was outstanding, which is not true. Then the creditor can go and take from these buyers in order to ensure repayment of his loan, because he is the first lien against the debtor. So the predated shtar is dangerous because it allows him to go after buyers of the property, other creditors of this debtor, even though he didn't have that existing lien. So what the Gemara says is, okay, if you assume that the shtar is problematic, then just don't allow him to go back to the original date. Just have the shtar be valid from the date that the loan was actually outstanding. So why don't we say that it's a valid shtar, it just has an invalid date on it? So Amar Rabbi Shimon Lokish b'machloket shnuyan. You're right. This din is in a machloket. V'Rabbi Meir he. And the author of that Mishnah in Shvi'it is Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir who says that when you do something wrong in a shtar, we penalize you completely and you lose everything. So just like by the shtar rebit, you lose everything, so too by the shtar mukdam, you lose everything because you predated the shtar, you did something wrong. Once you've done something wrong, it invalidates the shtar, and that means we invalidate it completely. So based on that, Reish Lakish says that Rabbi Meir is the author of that position in Shvi'it. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, afilu teimed the Rabbanan, you can even say it's the Rabbanan, gzeira shemi yigveh mizman harishon. Because there's a problem that if we say the shtar is valid, but the date is invalid, that works great as long as the people are aware of the fact that the date is invalid. This guy goes to some other Beit Din where they don't know this information. Or the buyers are unaware of the fact that there is this discrepancy within the shtar, then this individual can use the shtar with the improper date on it to collect improperly. And so we don't want to leave the shtar outstanding or allow him to use the shtar because there's a lot of risk in this shtar for people who don't know the information about the problem with the dating or the predating of the shtar. So Rabbi Yochanan says, even the Rabbonon in this case agree that we penalize him in this situation because of the fact that this is dangerous to have the shtar outstanding. Whereas by the case of the Karen and the Rebit, at least according to the Balei Tosafot and Rashi, it's obvious that the interest is in the document. There's nothing hiding in the document. So once we know or we're aware of the fact that the document includes interest in it, then no other Beit Din is going to collect interest. Because interest is known to be problematic. It's obvious in the shtar. And no other Beit Din is going to enforce the fact that there is an interest payment over here. So there the Chachamim did not need to put a gzeira in place. Whereas here by the shtar mukdam, they did have to put a gzeira in place. And that's why the Rabbanan's position differs over here than it does by the case of the loan with rebit in it. And even though in the case of the predated shtar, when we say here it's pasol, that's only pasol to get from mishabde, from the encumbered property, but you would be able to collect from unencumbered property. Unlike what the Balei HaTosafot suggests by the case of the contract with rebit, That is because, with regards to lending with ribit, the actual loan is what is problematic, not just the documentation in the shtar. On the other hand, by the case of the predating of the shtar, the loan itself was a fine loan. It is the shtar that is causing the problem. So therefore, the penalty in the case of the predating is in nullifying the shtar, but leaving the debt intact. And the penalty by the case of lending with ribit is to invalidate the loan completely. And now, how gavra, demashkin le pardesa le chavre. An individual gave as collateral his vineyard to his friend. Achla tlachne. The creditor ate from this or utilized the kerem for 3 years. Now, the significance of 3 years is really from the Gemara in Bava Batra, which is that after 3 years, a person can make a claim about property that they own it, they purchased it, and now that they've been there for 3 years, they have a chazakah on the property that it's theirs. And they no longer have to show the contract anymore for the sale, because after 3 years, we assume that the individual has established ownership. If anybody had questions about the ownership, they would have raised them already. So now he doesn't have to show a shtar. So what this dishonest creditor does is, sell me the vineyard now. Vilo, if you do not sell me the vineyard, kavishna la l'shtar mashkanta, I will subvert the contract that says that this is collateral. And then I will say that it is purchased in my hand. What he's going to say is, I bought it, and now I don't need a shtar because I've been there for 3 years. I'll rip up the shtar that says this was a mashkon, and now you have no defense. You're going to lose the property entirely. So I'm giving you an option. I'm basically extorting the property from you by saying, either I'm going to rip it up and say I bought it, and you'll lose the vineyard anyway, or you sell it to me. And obviously, I'm assuming that he wants it sold to him at a preferable price, but he's basically forcing the guy to sell the property to him because of the fact that he can declare the property his by simply saying, I bought it, and I've been there for 3 years. Azal kam aknei libno akatan. So the individual, knowing that he was under duress here, he was caught in a catch-22, he goes ahead and gives over the property to his son, who is a minor. Then he enters into a contract, selling it to the creditor, this dishonest creditor. So the sale is definitely invalid because the sale took place after he had already given it to his son. Now, what giving it to his son does is unclear over here. There are some Rishonim that believe when he gives it to his son, his son becomes the real owner of the property, and he does this secretly, so that his son becomes the owner of the property, and he's a katan. And as a katan, he can acquire, but he can't grant ownership. And so once this katan has it in his possession, he can never have it leave his possession until he's a gadol, and that basically locks the property into the katan. That's if you believe the katan really has ownership. If you think that this is just a ploy, an obvious ploy that he's trying to stop the sale to the creditor because the creditor is extorting the property from him, then the katan doesn't really own the property, even though the shtar will invalidate the shtar that comes afterwards. So since it's obvious that he's doing it as a ploy, he retains ownership over the property. It's just that the shtar to the katan will invalidate the sale that comes afterwards. So then in that case, it could be just as plausible that he gave it to his son who is of age, because it doesn't make a difference. There's no real acquisition or ownership of the property by the other party. Now, some suggest that even in that scenario, you wanted to give it to a katan, because by a gadol, he could be convinced the guy could pay him money to disgorge the property, meaning that there are ways that he could play on the gadol. Whereas by the katan, where he has no right to give over the property, over there, once he's given to the katan, that makes it a final transaction. So whether it's really in the hands of the katan now and he owns it, and that's why it fails here, the sale, or simply the fact that he did it, and it's the equivalent of him telling the edim when he signs on the sale contract, I'm doing this under duress, I really don't want to sell this property. Had he done that, that would have also worked to invalidate the sale. He's doing something that makes it clear that the subsequent sale was under duress, and that he does not want to make the sale, but not that the katan really owns it. But now, the Gemara says, so Zuze, the outstanding money, the guy paid him money for the field. So the money now becomes a debt outstanding, which he has to return because he sold the field with achrayut. He sold the field with recourse. So now that the field was not sold because it belonged to his son and he was improperly sold, he has to return the cash. When he returns the cash, or he has to replace the property, what type of responsibility does he have? So Zuzay Kimilve Bishkar Damu Vagove Minichasim Mishubadim. Is the loan considered to be a loan that has a document underlying it? Or in essence, he sold a property with recourse, and the document says it was sold with recourse, and so therefore now he can go after encumbered property to get his recourse? Odilma Kimilva Al Pedamu. Or do we say, since the contract here is invalidated, because he sold the property after it was already sold to his son, so the document is invalid, and therefore, so is the recourse that is written into the document invalid. And therefore, he has no right to collect from encumbered property. So the Gemara's question, at least according to the Ramban and many other Rishonim, is what is the right here of the individual when you invalidate the contract? Once I've invalidated the contract, does that mean that the contract is completely invalid? It's completely invalid. Not only are my rights to buy the field nullified, so is my right to recourse is also invalidated. And if that's the case, I'm just like an oral creditor and I can get my money back or the property replaced as an oral creditor. On the other hand, if you believe that the invalidation of the contract for the sale doesn't invalidate the underlying fact that there is an obligation here or a contract that indicates an obligation, then the recourse would still be alive in the contract, and the contract would be valid by which to get the recourse done or mimishabdeh to go after encumbered property. That's the nature of the Gemara's question. V'amar Abaye, v'lav hainu d'Ravasi. Isn't this similar to the case of Rabbi Asi? D'amar Rabbi Asi, Rabbi Asi says, mode b'shtar katavo, eno tzarich v'kaimo. That if the debtor agrees to a contract, agrees to an outstanding debt that is brought forth by a creditor, we do not need to validate the contract because of the fact that we have the debtor agreeing the fact that there's an outstanding debt. But goven minichasim mishubadim. And you have the right then to collect from encumbered property. So now, the Ramban continues to explain here, and it's difficult to understand why this situation of Rabbi Asi is relevant to our situation. In our situation, we're dealing with an invalidated contract, and we want to know if the other terms are severable from the invalidated sale to say that they're still in force. That's the question. Rabbi Asi is talking about a case of a contract by which the creditor shows up with a contract, and the borrower, the debtor, says, yes, it's a valid contract. And his validation makes it that we don't need to go separately validate it. It automatically becomes an enforceable contract. So what does that have to do with our case over here? So the way that the Ramban explains it is that the right of the loveh over here to validate the contract is interesting. So you basically have what is otherwise an invalid contract, and then the debtor is able to validate it or give it a certain amount of validation to collect from encumbered property. And so what the Ramban says is that's similar to our case. Our case here is where we have an invalid contract, but there are parts of the contract which are enforceable based on the recourse that's embedded in the contract. And so that's what we want to know. When we have a contract that doesn't have validity, except for the fact that it has certain parts of it that make obligations that should be independent of the invalid part, what does that mean? Or the case of Rabbi Asi, whereby the loveh, the debtor, makes it into a valid contract, even though the contract itself is not valid, and he allows you through that validation to collect from encumbered property. So that's what we want to know here. Is it the case? And Abaye suggests, based on this, that we should say that it is that way. The Baal Yad Tosafot are bothered by this and suggest that the nature of the question of the Gemara is different. He says, Tema, Ma'inya de Rabbi Asi the Khan. Why is Rabbi Asi relevant here at all? Ishlamar, Achalom Ibaile, Igabi Mishabde Ilo. Gemara's question is not whether you collect from encumbered property or not. Umibayale, this is the question of the Gemara. Ilo Gabi Mishabde, Kevin de Ashtar, In Ashtar Mo'il, Ela Piho Dato. Is the fact that you do not collect from the encumbered property because the shtar is only helpful based on the admission of the debtor, Odilma Gave, or maybe you do get to collect it? Meaning, is the validation of the other party sufficient? Over there, the admission of the debtor makes it into a valid contract. Even though, if he had said mizuyafu, If he had said it was invalid or it was a forgery, then he would require a validation. Then when he goes and admits it and affirms it, what type of power does he have over here? Hachanami, also in our case, Gabi Pardesa. The same thing is true by the Pardes, because El Mishum de Pshita Le de Neman Omar Parati Mishum de Lo Nitan Li Katev. Since this contract was completely invalid in its writing, then the debtor can say, Parati, I paid it off. And since he has a right to say he paid it off, he could cause an invalidation of the contract. And therefore, when he agrees that the contract is outstanding, it's his affirmation that's making it into a valid contract. And since his validation is what makes it into a valid contract, that is the comparison to Rabbi Yassi. Comparison to Rabbi Yassi is there, the debtor is the one who's giving validation to the contract, even though he himself could invalidate the contract. So Tosfot's underlying assumption is that the individual here has the right to say parati. He has a right to say that I paid off the contract. And since he has that right in our situation, thereby making it that his admission that this is an outstanding recourse, his admission is what gives validation to the contract. And similarly, by Rabbi Yassi, the admission of the debtor is what gives validation to the contract. Because had he said it was mizuyaf, had he said that it was a forgery, it would require validation. So the comparison between the cases is when you have the entire validation of the contract coming from the debtor or the party who is subject to the recourse, does that validation make it that you're allowed to collect from Mishabdeh? That's the parallel that's drawn here. The underlying reason for what Tosafot says is because he believes here that the individual can say parati. He could say, I paid it off, and he would be believed. The other Rishonim, like the Ramban, disagree and say that you don't have a right to say parati over here, and that's not why the contract is valid. The question is, when you have a portion of the contract that is valid and a portion of the contract that is invalid, the valid portion of the contract, can it stand independently of the invalid part? So here where there is a sale that went on that is invalidated, does the recourse that is involved in the contract still remain valid? And that's the same question that you would ask by Rabbi Yassi, which is in a case where you have a contract that can be invalidated by the debtor saying it's mizuyaf, when he comes along and says that it is valid, is that enough to create a validation of the contract because he's saying now that it is valid? So what would otherwise be invalid, we're saying has a portion of it that is valid, either because the debtor is saying it, or here in our case, because the recourse exists, or it may exist independent of the sale. And so that's the nature of the question according to the Ramban versus the Tosafot that we just explained. Now the Gemara says, Amalei Rova, Midomi, how can you compare these cases? Hotam nitan li katev. Over there, it's permissible to write it. Hacha lo nitan li katev. Here, it was not permissible to write it. Meaning that with regards to the outstanding loan that is there, the debtor agrees there was a loan. The contract was a valid contract or a valid credit note when it was written. Over here, the contract is completely invalid from the outset. It was a sale that should never have been written because he didn't have the right to sell the property. So how can you compare the cases? How can you parallel the case by which the original documentation is completely false in our case here by the Pardesa versus the case of Rabbi Yassi where the original contracting or outstanding debt was written properly? Just a question if the loan is still outstanding today. That's a separate question, but it's not a question about the validity of the origination of the document. And so the cases should be different. Yotim Mereimar v'kamar la'ashmaititah. So Mereimar said over this, Amalei Ravina l'Mereimar Elohad Amar Rabbi Yochanan Zera Shem Yigva Mimizman Rishon. So then why did Rabbi Yochanan have to say that the problem with the predated shtar is the fact that he might go and collect from the original date? Name Elo Nitan Li Katev. Just say that it's a completely invalid shtar. Since it's a completely invalid shtar, you have no rights of collection with that shtar at all. Amalei Achiyashto. That case is also not parallel. Hotam Nehid Elo Nitan Li Katev Mizman Rishon. Aval Nitan Li Katev Mizman Sheni. So even though there the contract is invalid because of the predating, the underlying contract, with the exception of the date, is telling the truth and is a valid contract. Whereas over here, by the case of the Pardesa, the entire sale is invalid from start to finish. So you actually have three different stages here. You have a contract which is completely invalid from start to finish. That's the sale to Pardesa where he had given to his son already. The case of where he predated the shtar, there it's invalid as written, But the shtar itself could be valid had the date been correct on it. So the shtar itself is a valid shtar, precluding the, with the exception of the dating on the shtar. And then you have a case like Rabbi Assi, where the shtar is completely valid. It was written at the time that the debt was outstanding. Our only question is the debt still outstanding? But as far as the shtar itself, the shtar is completely a valid shtar. So, halcha lo nitan likatev klal. But our case, the pardesa, it shouldn't have been written at all. Elohadetanyo, what about this? The shevach karkaot ketzad. This is a mishnah that deals with the tikkun olam with regards to the collection of shevach karkaot. That means if an individual stole a property and then sold it to a third party. Now, once they find out that it was stolen property, the original owners of the property come and confiscate, take back their property. The person who bought the property from the gazlan now is out all of his money. Not is he only out the money that he paid for the field, he's out the money that he invested in the field. The Mishnah says over there that he has a right of collection of the principal amount from encumbered property of the gazlan, and for the shevach, he only can go after free and clear property. And that is a takanat chachamim, because otherwise nobody would be able to transact in the market, because there's always a risk that when someone invests in a property they bought prior to you, their claim could far exceed the assets of this individual. And therefore people would not lend to that individual, people would not buy from that individual. So they had to cap out the liability that was associated with the debt. And so they precluded shevach from being included because it's an amorphous or unquantifiable amount of money that could be invested in the field. So in that case, the Sheva Karkaot Ketzad, Gazal Sadeh Mechaviro, stole a field from his friend, and Machra Le'acher, and sold it to a third party, Vishbichan, the third party now improved the property. It gets given back to the original owners, means confiscated and given back to the original owners, because there was no real sale here. Shugoveh Takerim Menichasim Mishubadim, when he collects the principal amount, he collects from the encumbered property of the Gazlan, meaning that whenever the date of the sale of the Gazlan was, his recourse against the Gazlan becomes a firm lien on the Gazlan from that date, and he can go after people who bought property after that date. The Shevach goveh minechasim b'nei chorim. But the Shevach, as we noted before, can only be taken from free and clear property because of the risks involved with Shevach. So now Gemara says, Neima, lo nitan likatev. Here's a case where the shtar is completely invalid. Here, there was no right of the Gazlan to write a shtar to sell it to the third party. He didn't own the property to sell in the first place. So this is similar to our case of the Pardesa, where the contract is completely invalid from day one. Yet, we say over here, he has a right to collect from encumbered property. So in our case as well, the recourse should allow him to take from encumbered property. Where it says, Achiyashti, you can't compare the cases. Hotam, Ilam Andamar Necheled Lo Nikre Gazlan. Over there, the Gazlan's gonna work hard to retain the property or keep it in the hands of the buyer. Either because he prefers not to be called a gazlan, to be called a thief. And if this property gets confiscated and then given back to the original owner, he's going to be known as a thief. And he doesn't want that shame. Either mandamar nechle delikum be'emnute, or according to the one who says that the person wants to stand by their word, and they gave their word and they sold it, even though they were selling stolen property, they still want to keep their word, and therefore, mifayis le demare umukim le deshtare. So therefore, they go and try to pay off the original owner and buy the field from him in order to maintain or affirm the sale that they did to this third party. So in this case, he has both an incentive and maybe even possibly in mind when he sells it to the third party that he's going to make sure that that property stays with the third party. He'll do whatever it takes to keep it in the hands of the third party, whether that means paying the original owners, whatever that he can do to try to keep it so that the transaction stays intact. So there is incentive to keep the transaction intact. Whereas over here in our case, over here, his whole intent of giving it to his son was to stop the transaction from happening, was to block the ability to sell it to this creditor who was taking advantage of him. And since his whole intent was to invalidate the shtar in essence, then how can you say that he's mikayim a portion of the shtar? It must be that he means to completely invalidate the shtar. So now in the end, we actually have here now four different levels of invalid shtar. We have an invalid shtar, like our case over here, where the shtar is completely invalid, and the party to the shtar that wanted it to be invalid intended for it to be invalid, and it being invalid is actually to his advantage, and that's what he wants. So that's the most extreme form. That's our case of Pardesa. And that's why we have a question over there, whether the person has a right to collect a mimishavde in that case, because the shtar is completely invalid. And that is what the person who signed on the shtar really wants. He wants it to be invalid. All his actions indicate that he wants it to be invalid. So then, can you say that the recourse still remains valid in that case? That's the question by our case. There's a next case, which is a case where, for instance, the Gzela case, where he sells it, where the shtar is also invalid from the outset. But over there, the person who engaged and sold the property, and he is a party to the shtar, wants the shtar to work. He wants the shtar to remain valid. Since he wants it to remain valid, he'll make efforts to have it remain valid. And so since his attitude is not that it's invalid from the outset, and I don't care, but rather it is invalid, but I know it's stolen, but I want to make this shtar valid. And since that's their intent, that's why you're gove mimishabde. Then there is a case of the predated shtar. In the case of predated shtar, it's not valid based on the date, but it is valid at a later date, and that's what gives you the right to go after mishabde. They had it not been from the gezerah of Rabbi Yochanan. And then there is the case of Rabbi Yassi, by which there was a valid contract, and now the debtor is affirming it, making it to a valid contract. There, the contract was completely correct or valid from the outset. It was just a matter of whether it was paid or not paid, but we have a valid contract over here, and there clearly you can, once the debtor admits that it's outstanding, collect even mimishabde. So in that case here, we have these four different levels of invalid contracts, and the question of the right of that contract to collect. In all these cases, it seems that you would collect from encumbered property, with the exception of the predated shtar, where Rabbi Yochanan says there's a gzeirah preventing you from doing it. According to Reish Lakish, you would be able to collect from Mishabde, because it would be the Shita of the Rabbanan versus Rabbi Meir. In our case, of the Pardesa, where you have question as whether you can go after the encumbered property or not, because the shtar is so invalid. So that's the nature of the Gemara's question. Okay, now we move on to a Mishnah, which we've discussed numerous times here in the Perek, because the Gemara had quoted it a number of times, which is Ein Poskim al Pirot ad Sheyetzei Ashar. One may not contract for future delivery of produce until the market price is out, until there's a valid, obvious, and clear market price that exists at this time. Because Yetzei Ashar Poskim, once the clear market price is out there, you can enter into such a futures transaction by which you pay him the price today for future delivery. That is because even if you don't have it in possession right now, someone else does have it in possession. And so therefore, when he hands you the money, you could deliver it today. Your choice to deliver it later, that's a choice that you're making. But it has an impact, and we'll explain that in a second. Just a note, this little piece here, as you can say, is that there's a question as to whether this piece is in the girsa of the Gemara. There's a Tosfot back on Samach Ben Amud Bet that suggests that the reason the Gemara calls it a Braita back then is because this piece, Yatzah Shara Poskim Al-Pishen Lezeh, Yesh Lezeh, is actually not found in the Mishnah, and is only found in a Braita. And so that's why the Gemara back there says Titania instead of Ditznan. And so Tosfot thinks that this line may not be in the Mishnah. Our Mishnah has it in, but it might be an addition from a Braita. But the idea being that what we want to happen is that if there's a change in the market price, that advantage or that increase in value is accruing to the buyer because he already owns the item. If he owns the item, then the item is going up in his possession. It's appreciating under his ownership. And so that can happen in one of two ways. Either the individual has the produce in hand today, and since he has the produce in hand today, when he sells it to him for future delivery, it's as if the individual takes ownership of it today, figuratively, and then it appreciates in his possession. And that's why it's not going to look like interest. So even though you gave him money up front, which is the equivalent of a loan, or looks like a loan, since it's done derech mecher, it's done in a transactional manner, and we can assign the property or item to the individual right now, we assume that it's appreciating in his hand. Similarly, even if the person who's selling here does not have it in his possession, but there is an open and obvious market price for it, then when he receives the cash, it's as if he takes that cash and goes into the market and buys on behalf of this individual what he's obligated to deliver. And since he could do that, we look at it as if it was done, And since it's if it was done, that means that it's appreciating in the hands of the purchaser again, and that's why it's not problematic. The case where it's problematic is when there is neither the item in the possession of the seller, nor is there an obvious market price out there. Then when the individual gives him cash today for the produce at whatever market price they are using or whatever price they deem, later on when the price of the commodity goes up, and now he delivers to him produce that is more valuable than the produce that he was purchasing at the time, then that looks like interest in the end. Because he bought it for sa'ah, the seller, and then later on it's now gone up in value. It's only 3 sa'ah to the seller. So when he returns him 4 sa'ah instead of 3 sa'ah, it looks like he's paying interest for the forward payment or the original deposit of the money. So that is what the Mishnah is saying over here. There are those that want to explain that when it says here, Aval Pishen Lazeh, Yesh Lazeh, is not referring to the supplier's ability to procure the item, but rather the purchaser's ability to buy the item. And that is based on what Rabba and Rav Yosef Damrei Tarvayu said back on Daf Samach Gimel Amud Bet, that the reason why it's not considered to be interest is Poskim Al Hashar Shebashuk, Aval Pishen Lo, Darmalei Shkila Tivutech, Vishadya Chizrei Mahanit Li. Because you can make the claim, what did you benefit me? I could have bought from someone else. I didn't need to buy from you. So buying from you, I should be able to lock in the price today. And you can't come back to me in the end and say you get the higher price because of the fact that I didn't need to buy from you. I could have gone to anybody. I could have gone to the whole market and bought at this price. So you've done nothing to benefit me at this point in time that you can demand a higher price. And that is the why over here it's not considered to be interest, is because the buyer can say, you're providing me no benefit. I could have bought the item, put it away in my house. I could have contracted with someone else and gotten it. Or I could go to another location and purchase it at that same price. So since I had the ability to procure it at the same price somewhere else, you did nothing to benefit me that I should be considered problematic over here and should not be able to garner the full amount of the delivery later on and deem it as interest. And based on that, it actually solves a problem as to what the benefit or the addition of Rabba and Rav Yosef was back then. We asked the question when we learned the daf in Samach Gimel Amud Bet, which is, what's the difference between what they're saying over there and our Mishnah over here? So Rashi over there said that the Chiddush was that there was an opinion there that says, Ein poskim al ashar shibashuk, that there were individuals, and we're going to see that in a second in the Gemara, who don't believe that the Mishnah is correct, and that thought that that was not the case. So Rabbi and Rav Yosef coming to tell us, yo, that is the case. They were passing like that. The Balei Tosafot were somewhat uncomfortable with that, and then we gave other explanations as to what Rabbi and Rav Yosef were adding to the picture. But if you explain our Mishnah as being what Rabbi and Rav Yosef said, then it actually makes it easier, is that there's no Chiddush. They're telling us, they're interpreting for us the reason behind the Mishnah over here, is that the buyer, the purchaser, has the ability to go somewhere else, not the supplier has the ability to go somewhere else. That's an alternate explanation of that line in the Mishnah. So now the next line in the Mishnah is, Hayahu tchila lekutzrim. He was the first. He had an early harvest. And now he has the product in possession. Posekim ala gadish. He can, at that time, at the pile where the grain is, you can sell it forward to this individual because it's in your possession now. And you're selling it forward to him for future delivery. That is totally fine because you're in possession of it. Vala vit shel anavim, or the vessel that is holding the grapes. They keep the grapes in there for them to ripen and soften so that they're easier to press later on. A matan shel zeitim, and this is a similar type of utensil, but it's used for the olives to soften them. Vala beitzim shel yotzer, or the clay of the potter. But here is a person who makes clay utensils. So he has the block of clay ready to be made. It was in a circle, kept in a circle, and then he worked with it. So if that's already there, vasid mishishako bekivsan, or the plaster, cement, or lime that is already now in the oven or in the kiln, you can, at that time, sell it for forward delivery. Since you have the item in possession, you can sell it for forward delivery, and we don't worry about market fluctuations in the price of this object because it's as if you've delivered it to him today, and you're holding on to it for him on his behalf, and the appreciation is happening in his hands. And since you have it in possession today, that is sufficient. Now Rashi over here gives the explanation is, Bezer Sharshi Yirtzeh, you can determine whatever price you want today. It sounds like from Rashi you can discount it as much as you want. Even though Tosfot back on Samach Gimel Amud Daled says that there is a maximum discount which can be down to the Shar Lekutot, which we'll meet later on in the Gemara. So there is a maximum discount that you're allowed to offer. Unlike what Rashi seems to indicate here, which it's an unlimited discount. Latet lo mioto gadish, as long as you have the item in possession. The Kevin de Yeshlo, ein kan ribit. Since he has it in possession, there is no interest. The machshavu kanuilo. Because it goes into his possession from today. Va'afo pishlo mashach. Even though there's no kinyan mishicha. So what brings it into the possession of the buyer over here? If there's no formal kinyan on the object at which he's going to deliver. The reason being is because even if he didn't have it in hand, the restriction against doing such a transaction is only a rabbinic restriction. Because it looks like ribit when you hand him back produce that is worth more in the end versus the money or the produce that you borrowed up front. So that's why it is avak ribit. And Rashi says over here, when he has it in his possession, they are not gozur. The chachamim are not gozer in that case. So even though you don't need a formal kinyan to make it his, the chachamim in this case, where it optically looks much cleaner and it looks like it appreciated in the hands of the buyer, in that situation, they were not gozur. That's the way Rashi explains it over here. If you look back at Rashi on Daf Samach Gimel Amud Bet, and the Tosafot on Samach Bet Amud Bet, those over there says, Afogri delo mashach chitim, even though he did not make a kinyan mishicha on the chitim, kevin shemaya ba mocher lagzor, avakai b'mishiporo. If he wanted to back out of the transaction, he would be subject to mishiporo. And Rashi, back on Samach Gimel Amud Aleph, says something similar, which is that the reason that it's locked in is because you're subject to mishiporo. So Rashi and the Bali et Tosafot back on Samach Bet Amud Bet and Samach Gimel Amud Aleph indicate that the reason that it works over here, or it's not considered to be interest when you have it in possession, is because you're subject to mishipara. Since you're subject to mishipara, you can't walk away from the transaction. So that makes it enough in the possession of the buyer that is appreciating it in his possession. Tosafot back there says that you don't have to deliver this exact item, but the mere fact that you have it in possession is enough. Not that he gets a full-fledged kinyan on the object or on the merchandise. Simply, we deem it as if he has a kinyan there. But Tosafot on Samach Daled Amud Bet makes it clear that even if you switch it out or you deliver him something else, all of that is considered to be a valid mechanism of delivery. And so therefore, there's a machloket here as to whether the heter of when you have it in possession derives from the mishipara aspect of it, that you can't walk away from the transaction without being subject to a klala, or does it derive from the fact that the chachamim were not gozer in this instance, since it's only a bakri beat anyway, in the instance when you have it in his possession, we look at it as if he bought it already, even though there's no kinyan mishicha, and the chachamim were not gozer in that case. So those are two ways to formulate why it works in this instance. So then the Mishnah continues and says, Uposiki mo'ala zevel, kol yimot hashana. And you're allowed to contract for future delivery of dung any time of the year. Obviously, the assumption here is that dung is easily procured. And if you don't have it, you can borrow it from someone, you can buy it from someone. There's always dung around that you can get. And therefore, it's considered as if it is always available to you. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Do'olam ein poskim ala zevel, im enkein haita lo zevel bashpa. Rabbi Yossi says, no, it has the same din as everything else in this Mishnah, that only when you have it in possession are you allowed to guarantee for forward delivery. Otherwise, you cannot do it, and it's like any of the other products that we mentioned before in the Mishnah. V'chamim matirim. Now then, the chamim say it is fine. Uposek imo b'shara gvoa, and you're allowed to be posek based on the, Rashi says gvoa here means the higher quantity price, which means the cheaper price. So that means that if you say today that I'm going to buy the object from you today for future delivery, you can say to him that I get it at today's price, or if the price is cheaper later on, I get it at the price then. And so that is a valid transaction by which you are basically saying I get the lower of today's price or the future price. That is a valid transaction. It's not clear in this part of the Mishnah, the Posekim El Bashar Gvoa, whether that's modifying the entire Mishnah, or is that only in the case where the market price is available, and the Rishonim argue as to what it is modifying in the Mishnah. And then Rabbi Yehuda says, Afal Pishalo Pasakim El Bashar Gvoa, Yechol Omar Lo, Tein Li Kazeh, O Tein Li Et Ma'utai. Rabbi Yehuda says that that is the default scenario. The way that the Tanakama suggested is if you agree to that type of transaction, it's fine. Rabbi Yehuda says if there's no other agreement to the contrary, that that is the default scenario, which is that if you buy something for forward delivery, then you get the lower of the two prices. You get the lower of today's price or the future delivery price. And that's embedded by default in the transaction. That's the way Rabbi Yehuda says it. Now Rashi, in explaining this, says, Tein li kazeh, tein li ma'utai, sherelo mashach. There was no kinyan meshicha here. Rabbi Yechol lachzor bo, and he can back out of the transaction. Va'afilu misha para leka. There's not even a penalty of misha para. Ho'yo v'lo natan ma'utav, amanat dekabel achshav. Because he didn't pay the money to get delivery today. Ela la'achar zman. But rather, for future delivery. Omitokach nishtaneh ashtar. And in that period of time, or that interim, the price has changed. So stam dati dinish atara zolo pasik. And therefore, what Rabbi Yehuda says is when a person buys something, he has the intent to take the lower of the two prices. And that is exactly what the seller is basically agreeing to. So Rabbi Yehuda says that is the default status. The Chachamim says it's not the default status, but if that is the agreement, then it is a valid agreement. It goes against what Rashi himself said back on Sama Gimel Amun Aleph, and we quoted this Rashi before to explain why when you have it in possession, that it's not a problem of akribit. Rashi over there says you are subject to mishib para. And Rashi over here in the Mishnah says you are not subject to mishib para in this case. Now, that could be because Rashi in this Mishnah thinks that the reason why the transaction is not considered to be a problematic transaction is because lo gozer rabbanan, not because of mishib para. And once you do that, then the whole Mishnah, according to Rashi, has nothing to do with mishib para. Versus Rashi back on Samach Gimon Aleph, who thought that the reasoning behind why it's not considered to be a vakri bit when you have it in possession is because of the Misha Para that locks you into the transaction. If that's the case, then the Misha Para over here should lock you into the transaction based on Rabbi Yehuda. And then what you have to explain is that what Rabbi Yehuda is suggesting is that there is no Misha Para here because this is the intent of the transaction. The original intent of the transaction was that you get the lower of the two prices, and therefore you're not even subject to Misha Para for walking away from it, because that was the original intent of the transaction. Right? Amar Rabbi Yassi, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Ein poskim al ashar shebashuk. You're not allowed to be poseik on the going market price in the shuk. This seemingly goes against our Mishnah. So Amar Rabbi Zera, Rabbi Yassi, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Afilu kedurmus hazeh. Even like this large durmus, as Rashi explains over here, itliz gadol, it's a large shuk or a large marketplace. Samalei, lo amar Rabbi Yochanan ele b'shuk shel ha'arayot, lo kviya tarayu. Now Rabbi Yochanan's restriction against setting a price for forward delivery based on a market price was only in the case where it was shuk shel ha'arayot. Was in the cities, but here we're talking about the smaller cities or in the villages where there was a price, but it was a very local price. It wasn't a price that gave already like a regional or a large shuk price. It was that particular location's price. And he says you can't set it based on that because those are fluctuating market prices. They don't have a steady price. So what the Gemara is saying now is that Rabbi Yochanan's restriction is in a case where you're dealing with a smaller market that is determining a market price. When you have large markets or large, more regional market price that is more stable, that's where the Mishnah says it is fine. So now the Gemara says, Ulamad desaka da'atin mikara. According to the original thought of the Gemara, where it says that Amar Rabbi Yochanan filu kedumar sezeh, that Rabbi Yochanan would have said that it's invalid, even when you're dealing with very large shuk, elamatnitan dektanin poskina perot at sheyeshe ashar, that when our Mishnah says you are allowed to do this, Yatzar Shar Poskim Echi Mishkachala. Where's the case that that is true? My answer is Matnita and Bechite de Akalbe Varabe. The Mishnah is talking about a case where you are taking out the wheat from the storehouses and from the boats. The Moshuk Tare Tfei. Because over there, you have a long tail to the market price. The market price at that point is extremely stable and long lasting. And so because of that, it becomes a real market price. So based on this, you actually have three tiers of market pricing that the Gemara is indicating. There is the local market price, which is the market price, whether it's in the village or in a particular city. There is a market price, which is, we'll call it a regional market price, which is large shuk, where people come around from all the suburbs and come there. And then you have a market price, which is a, call it a national market price, where a market price is extremely stable and long-lasting because it's at the point where everybody is selling. All the boats are delivering wheat. All the storehouses are opening up. Everybody's got wheat, and therefore whatever the price is then is extremely stable and extremely long-lasting. So that is what Rashi said back on Daf Samach Gimel and Amud Bet, that the Chiddush of Rabbi and Rabbi Yosef is that we don't paskin like this Mandamar that says that the only time it's mutar to go out and be posek al ashar is when you're dealing with that national price. But we actually paskin like the regional price is sufficient to make it into a shar that you can transact on. That's what Rashi said, Rabbi and Rabbi Yosef's Chiddush was versus our Mishnah to say don't think like this. But that's what the Gemara says. Originally, we thought Rabbi Yochanan said it was asur. We meant both the local price, the regional price. Everything was asur except for this, like, wide, national, long-lasting price. The Gemara comes along and says in the end, no, that Rabbi Yochanan believes that it's only the village or local price that doesn't work. It's a regional price that's already sufficient grounds on which to create transactions. Tan Rabbanan, in Puskin al Peirot, ad sheyetzei ashar. One may not establish a transaction for forward delivery until the market price is out. Yatza shar poskim. If the market price is out, you can do it. Avo pishen lezeh, yesh lezeh. Because even if this one doesn't have it, someone else has it. Hayu chadashot mi arba, vishanot mi shalosh. If the new grain, you get 4 sa'ah to the seller, vishanot, and the older grain, you get 3 sa'ah to the seller. Ein poskim, you're not allowed to use that market price. Achiyeche ashar lechadash uli yashan. Until the market price of chadash and yashan, according to Rashi, are equal. There's some that say that there's a fixed pricing between them, or the difference between them is simply the amount of time that you have to process them or keep them in storage. So the difference in price is simply the carrying cost of the storage. Then that would be okay. But as long as there is a huge differential between the new and the old, then that doesn't mean that the price is settled in. Because once the price is settled in, there should be very little difference between the new and the old, especially since what you're trying to do here is get delivery of old. Because when you contract with them at today's prices for future delivery, the future delivery will be old product by the time you get it. And so therefore, we want some sort of equality between the new and old pricing to know that it is actually established a stable price by which you can contract. If the prices are still very far apart, that means that there's not enough of the new produce in the market to establish its price or bring it in line with the older product that's in the market. If you were looking for delivery today, then it wouldn't be a question because then you're actually buying whatever is available today and taking delivery today. The fact that you're looking for future delivery means that in the end, it's going to be yashan. If that's the case, there will be a point in time where the new produce will sell for forward delivery as the same price that the current older wheat is available. Again, maybe with the differential for the storage over that period of time. Problem is that if you bought old wheat, which is ready to be used today, it would be more expensive. So you're buying unready wheat or unripened wheat for future delivery when it will be ready. And so what the Gemara is saying is that since you're buying it for delivery when it's going to be usable the way that the old wheat is used today, we want that price to be equal to the usable old wheat today. That's what it should be. For future delivery of that wheat, at the same state of the wheat today, should garner the same price, assuming that you compensate for the carrying cost. If you got delivery today, you would get 3 sa'ah to the seller. If you take delivery for the future, when it's in the exact same state as what you would get in the yashan today, it should also cost 3 sa'ah to the seller. The fact that you can buy chadashot at 4 sa'ah to the seller shows you that there's not a well-established price yet, because the only difference should be the carrying cost of the time between. The fact that the spread in price is so big right now shows you that people are discounting heavily the new wheat for future delivery, or in essence, the fact that it's discounted today means that you're really discounting it to get the cash. And that means that you're really paying an effective interest to get the cash up front. Because otherwise, the only difference in price should be the carrying cost of taking the new wheat to get it to the point that it's old wheat, the shrinkage, whatever is involved from the drying out of the wheat. But other than that, there should be no differential in the price. Once you've accounted for that, there should be a small differential in price. When you have a wide differential between 4 sa'ah to sell it and 3 sa'ah to sell it, that's because people are trying to get money up front, and it means that they're really borrowing the money, or effectively borrowing the money. Because otherwise, the difference between buying old wheat today and old wheat for future delivery should just be, again, the carrying cost and the shrinkage cost and nothing else. If the stuff that is gathered together, I'd call this a consolidator. It could be a consolidator because they're a wholesaler and they're consolidating from suppliers, or it can be a consolidator because he's an ani, and he goes around and collects from different people's fields. Rashi claims it's actually different grains getting mixed up. There's wheat, and she found there's some rye that's mixed in with it. But the chol adam mishalosh. But if you buy it directly from the producer, you get 3 sa'ah to the seller. So it's cheaper to buy the mix than it is to buy from the particular individual. Ein poskim at yishei ashar lelokeit ulemocher. You can't buy from it until the lokeit and the mocher's price flatten out. Until the price for the mixed wheat is the same as the price for the pure wheat. Again, over here, there's going to be a difference in price. But the difference in price should solely be the quality differential, not the fact that one of them is giving it to you early, and one of them is giving it to you a little later. Again, the price differential or the discount can't just be because the guy is taking cash early. The discount or the differential price is simply to reflect the quality difference, not the difference in timing. So Amar Rav Nachman, poskim lekoot, kashar lekoot. Even if the price is not out for both the lekoot, the collectors or the aggregators, and for the private sellers, nevertheless, if you want to buy from an aggregator, you can buy from the aggregator at the aggregation price. So Amar Rav Nachman, maishna lokeit, di leitle yozif milokeit chavrei. Because if the lokeit doesn't have it, he can just borrow from his other friend who's an aggregator. He can get the stuff that's readily available in the market. Balabait nami yazif milokeit. The Balabait was yet to bring his harvest in or process his harvest. He can just go also out and buy it from the aggregator. So Balabait zilabe milta lemizaf milokot. That it's embarrassing or beneath his dignity to borrow from someone who is an aggregator. He has his own stuff and he would not go out and borrow from someone else. Ibaidema manda yoiv zuze the Balabait aperi shapiri yahiv. Or the problem is that when you buy from a balabait, you expect a higher quality product. And so that's the key differential. The differential between the mocher and the locate is the quality of the produce that is being sold. If the price simply reflects the difference in quality, then the prices are out and you can contract at those prices. If the difference in price has to do with the availability today of the locate to sell you early versus the mocher who only sell you later, then that hakdama, or a prepayment of the price, is basically a discount for giving cash up front. If it's a discount for giving cash up front, that already is deemed interest or avak ribit. Amrav sheshet, amrav huna. Ein lavin ala shar shebashuk. You're not allowed to lend money based on the current market price. Rashi over here, and you can see it in the Tosfot as well, there are two ways to explain this. Rashi says, ani shamati, I heard ein lavin ma'ot, b'derech halva'a. You can't lend money, cash, as a cash loan. If he doesn't pay back the money until a certain time, in lieu of that monetary payment, I will give you produce at today's prices. So the person borrows money, and in borrowing that money, he has a right to return the cash, or he can return in lieu of the cash the produce that would be deliverable at today's market price. Because even though if you did this as a transaction, it would have been mutar, derech halva'a asur. The problem here is that you did it as a loan. Had you contracted it as a forward sale and said, I'm buying the produce today for forward delivery, that would have been fine. The fact that you lent him money and said, I'm lending you money for that either return of the money or the forward delivery, at today's prices, that's problematic because it's structured as a loan instead of as a transaction. But the Geonim explain this Gemara differently. They say that this is the restriction of lending sa'a b'sa'a that we've spoken about before, which is he can't lend you a sa'a today for the return of a sa'a in the future. Because when you lend him the sa'a today, the market price is lower. When he returns the sa'a to you, the market price is higher. And so it looks like he is paying you interest, because effectively when he gives you the same sa'a back later on, it's worth a lot more money if you monetize it then. And that's the problem over here. Because you would have thought, since I could procure the item from somewhere else, so you're not benefiting me. Since you're not benefiting me, then you can't say that it's problematic. And it'd be the equivalent of the guy saying, I have it in hand, you just need to wait for my son to bring the key, or something like that, and it's yours. But we don't say that. When you lend a sa'a, we don't say that you have the ability to procure it anywhere and return it anywhere. But rather, when you return it at a later date, it's as if, or deemed as if interest, because of the appreciation in the price. So that's how the Gaonim explain it. And you can see, just the Gemara continues, says, Amalei Rav Yosef bar Chamla Rav Sheshit, Vamei la Ravah Yosef bar Abba Rav Sheshit, Umiyam Rabav Huna Achi. Does Rav Huna really say this? Va'abai mi name Rav Huna. They ask the question of Rav Huna. Hana b'nei Rav, the Talmidim of the Yeshiva, Diyazfei b'Tishrei, they borrow money in Tishrei, Uparei b'Tevet, and then they pay it back in the winter. Shari, O Asir, is that mutar or is that asur? So whichever way you think the transaction that Rav Huna was speaking about before, that's what they're doing here. Either, according to Rashi, they were borrowing money with an obligation to return the money or the equivalent produce at today's market price. Or, according to the Baal Halachot Gedolot, the Gaonim, they were borrowing a sa'a in Tishrei and delivering back a sa'a in Tevet. So they asked Rav Huna, is that okay? Amlo, ha'chite behini v'ha'chite b'shilei. You could go and procure this somewhere else. Since you can procure it somewhere else, ibai zavne upari le miikara. At that moment, right away, you could have fulfilled your obligation, your forward delivery obligation. Since you had the ability to do it then, it is fine. The explanation is basically the explanation by our Mishnah. Why is it by our Mishnah that you're allowed to do it even though you don't have it in possession? Because you have the ability to procure it. If you can procure it today, then once he's handed you cash, according to Rashi, or according to the Baal Halachot Gedolot, we'll have to explain why this is mutar, because we know that sa'a b'sa'a is not mutar. And the conclusion of the Gemara here is it is mutar. So what is the scenario that the Baal Yitosvot explained? Fi Halachot Gedolot, ari sa'a b'sa'a, mayri b'yesh lo ma'ot lo've. That the borrower has cash in hand here. The matzi zavin b'shuka, o yesh lo ma'at. That he's able to procure it in the market, or he has some produce himself. So Tosfot says, in order to explain the Baal Halachot Gedolot, that sa'a b'sa'a is mutar, you have to come up with a scenario in which it is mutar, because we know sa'a b'sa'a is asur. So he says, either that the borrower has cash, and therefore he can go replace the sa'a he borrowed in the market at today's prices, or he has his own produce. Even though it's not the full amount of what he borrowed, but since he has some produce, he can contract for larger quantities than the produce that he has. And that is the way that the Tosfot solves the problem. The Tosfot over here introduces a new chiddush here, which many of the Rishonim take up, which is that when we say that you have something in possession, you're allowed to contract for future delivery, that might not mean that you have to have the exact quantity in possession. It just means that you have some quantity in possession that you could give to him today, because that effectively gives him a kinyan of some sort in the item. But not that you have to have the full amount. Tosfot says over here, you can contract even with small amounts in hand, for larger quantities. And that's a big chiddush that the Baal Yitosvot have. But he's doing this in order to understand why the sa'a b'sa'a, according to the Gaonim, is allowed in this case. And so he gives you one of two answers to deal with that. If you look at the Gra, he notes that the Ramban believes that the Gaonim were matir b'chol inyan. That sa'a b'sa'a is mutar b'shiyatza shar, ashuk. When there is a well-known market price, sa'a b'sa'a is mutar, according to the Gaonim. And that's what was happening over here. Sa'a b'sa'a is asur when it's not a well-known market price. So the Ramban has that chiddush, that the restriction of sa'a b'sa'a is only when there's not a well-known market price. The well-known market price, sa'a b'sa'a, is mutar. So now, mi'kara sa'a Rav Huna ain lavin. The truth is that Rav Huna originally believed that you couldn't structure a transaction like this. Came into Shema, the had amar shmu barchi amar Rav Elazar, lavin, after he heard that memra of shmu barchi amar Rav Elazar, that you're allowed to lend it, amar iu nami lavin. So then he too agreed that you can lend it out. So originally he thought that ain lavin al shabbos shuk. After you heard Rav Shmuel Bar Achiya and Rav Elazar say that you're allowed to lend out in that manner, he changed his mind to say Lavin, and that is the answer that he gave to the Bnei Bei Rav. And his earlier statement that he quoted from the name of Rav Sheshet was before he had gotten that new information. Okay, we're going to stop here, two lines from the bottom of Ayin Bet Amud Bet.